The following podcast is provided to you free, as is all our content, at drhoffman.com. If you'd like to listen, help support Intelligent Medicine, and get great values by shopping at our supplement store, go to drhoffman.com and click on Shop, then click on the store. Thanks, and enjoy the podcast. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today it's time for Q&A with Layla, which, judging by listener comments via email and online, one of your favorite episodes, one of your favorite themes for Intelligent Medicine. Each week we endeavor to answer your questions. You can email your questions to radioprogram@AOL.com. That's radioprogram@AOL.com. And we'll attempt to answer as many questions as possible. How are you doing, Layla?
I'm all right. How are you doing, Dr. Hoffman?
For a listening audience not familiar with Layla Mutin, she is Hoffman Center nutritionist, she's a registered dietitian, and she's earned an advanced master's degree in the field of nutrition. And she comes to the Hoffman Center via a previous stint at the prestigious Atkins Center in New York, and has now been with us, well, nearly 8 years, is that correct?
Yeah.
Time flies.
Oh, 5, yeah. Time flies.
Wow. And speaking of time flying, here we are, we find ourselves at the end of the summer.
Oh, I don't even like to say it. I go into a little bit of denial at the end of every summer. I could just live on the beach and be very, very happy. So okay. I like summer all the time.
Okay, so we may have to relocate the Hoffman Center and the Health Talk, I'm sorry, the Intelligent Medicine Program.
Yeah.
Health Talk is what we used to call this program. To where should we relocate it to?
Caribbean,
yeah. Well, you know, if we get to, you know, if some of our comments are a little bit, you know, out of line with the position of the American Medical Association and the FDA and the Federal Trade Commission, we may have to broadcast from an offshore ship, you know, in international waters.
We
so
could
maybe
do that.
We could arrange that. Okay.
Yeah, we can arrange that. We could have a Hoffman Center yacht.
The rent is probably cheaper than the rent in New York, so that might be a way to go. All right.
Okay.
Okay, so those of you who are patients at the Hoffman Center, don't despair because we're not, we do not have imminent plans to, you won't arrive one day at the Hoffman Center and find the door swinging open and then, you know, a draft running through the office and tumbleweeds and dust balls. Going through the office, we'll be there for a long time. Okay, so we have, you know, usually we'll have a little prelude on, you know, one of the big stories of the day, but we just got so many questions. By the way, I want you to give me some feedback on some of the questions that we got, because we have a selection process for questions, and we answer most questions that we can answer, but what are the types of questions that are really impossible for us to answer here on the air?
The ones that are really impossible is when you're sending us all of your personal medical information and your question is longer than maybe 3 or 4 sentences, mm-hmm. and we can't give a consultation on a podcast.
Right.
You know, it's we can't analyze for you, for instance, your thyroid labs that you got or your cholesterol labs or, mm-hmm. you know, your lipid panel or anything else.
Or listen to
we
a very
can answer some pretty yeah. I mean, we're getting a lot of questions. We're very, very happy that you're sending us your questions, but we can't solve your problems over a podcast.
Right, right.
So,
yeah. I mean, a generic question, you know, would be, you know, what does it mean? You know, a certain type of test. You know, we can explain something of general interest to our listening audience, but really, due to the strictures of medicine and correct practice. And even some of the liability considerations with dealing with people long distance who we haven't seen, we can't do very specific case handling for you. We can, you know, give you a heads up on a direction that you might pursue, and we're very happy to do that. But a very, a complicated medical case is not something that we can analyze. Mm-hmm. So that being said, you know, you hear some of the questions, you know, pretty specific, and you know, we'll provide you with our best take on a medical challenge you may face, or you know, concern about a medication, or a nutrient, or a lifestyle choice, or a food, or a diet mm-hmm. That you may be considering undertaking. Mm-hmm. Okay. So those are the ground rules.
Oh, yeah. These are the ground rules. Are we ready for questions?
Yeah. Fire away.
Great, great, great. This one comes to us from Marie, and I'm shrinking this. I'm trying to nutshell this one as much
Good.
As possible.
Yeah.
A friend of Marie's who is vegan was diagnosed with aggressive squamous cell cancer on his scalp.
Okay.
Now, had all the skin grafting done, but now the skin grafts are being rejected.
Mm-hmm.
And her question is this because her friend is vegan?
Right.
That they're not getting enough good quality protein. Does this have anything to do with why a skin graft is going to be rejected?
Yeah, and that's a really good question. And so the answer is that there are dietary concomitants to certain cancers. However, it mm-hmm. remains controversial as to whether, for example, meat is a cause of cancer. Actually, some studies show that there is a trend towards cancer in people consuming meat. The problem with many of these studies is that they don't look at processed meat versus organic grass-fed meat, so it's hard to indict meat, you know, that careful meat eaters consume, like we do and like we advocate for our patients who consume meat. And when it comes to squamous cell cancer of the skin, it's much more likely that the cause of that is excessive sun exposure in the absence of antioxidants, sun-protective antioxidants. I think that dietary antioxidants may play a role in whether or not you're going to get skin cancer if you're a light-skinned individual who's had too much sun exposure. But I think that the mutations caused in the DNA of your cells in surface skin are more determined by your degree of excessive sun exposure.
Yeah.
So now, the question, I mean, I'm answering a different question. You know, could this cancer be due to a vegan diet? In fact, a vegan diet is promising for this because it's very rich, usually, in antioxidants, unless it's a junk food vegan diet. I mean,
yeah.
Vegans can be on junk food vegan diets. We've seen some. You know, they consume, chips and, mm-hmm. various types of poor
just
quality,
a lot of grains.
Refined
yeah.
grains.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and lots of.
Lots of omega-6 fats there.
Right, omega-6
well.
Fat, exactly.
Yeah.
Refined oils that are polyunsaturated, and maybe that could have something to do with causation. But in rejection of grafts has to do with the immune system suddenly fighting off something that it feels is foreign. Now, usually when you have a graft, you have an autologous graft. You have a graft that they take from one part of your skin and put somewhere else. And so it's unclear why the graft is not taking, you know, a transplanted kidney or a transplanted liver, you know, comes from somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that would have to do with an immune rejection of something foreign. If
yeah.
it's your own tissue, it's unclear why that is not taking. It
yeah,
could be.
And this was skin that was grafted from his thighs.
Okay, so it is possible. I mean, I guess we could create a scenario where there's some type of nutritional deficiency that's preventing. Here, it's not a matter of an overactive immune system. It's a matter of poor healing that the graft is not taking.
Mm-hmm.
And we might see in someone who has nutritional deficiencies poor wound healing. I can't really comment. I know you can't really comment on this case because we don't have the data on this person. This person might be on the most restrictive diet.
That's true. I mean, if they're vegan, there are certain deficiencies we can almost assume,
yep.
like a B12, maybe the omega-3s. Things of that nature, certainly iron, if it's necessary. I mean, there are some things that we're concerned about with vegans.
Right.
Not getting it. But I don't know how that would pertain to rejection or non-rejection of a skin graft.
Right.
So
it may not pertain to this
yeah.
particular situation. Is this someone that we would mind seeing and analyzing? I mean, this is the kind of case that we might see and determine if there's some kind of nutritional support that will help this vegan have a more complete healing response. Basically, we're looking for a healing response because
yeah.
the tissue is it just doesn't take. It doesn't heal properly.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, best of luck to your friend, Marie. All right. Next question. Hi, Dr. Hoffman and Layla. My question is, do either of you use or have information regarding the effectiveness of detecting and monitoring cancer using an HCG test? There's some research that indicates if a person is not pregnant and does not have a serious bodily injury that is healing, it's likely detecting HCG from a cancerous tumor. I recognize that the test cannot indicate the location of the cancer. Now, this comes from Lois, Dr. Hoffman,
yep.
and she says she recently sent a urine sample which indicated that she's slightly positive.
Right.
So
and she's not pregnant.
She's not pregnant. So for 4 months, she's made some serious changes in her diet.
Well, wait a minute. I'm a little unclear. I've only just heard a little bit about this. I mean, what kind of doctor would use an HCG test to tell a patient that they might have cancer? That I just don't really get.
She sent her urine sample abroad.
Oh, boy.
Hmm. Yeah. She doesn't say where.
Yeah.
Recently sent abroad a urine sample which indicated I'm slightly positive.
Yeah.
So
well, you know,
change your diet. Yeah.
I just think that this is an unnecessary cause of worry because there's a specific type of cancer where a high level of HCG would indicate a cancer. That would be a choriocarcinoma, which is a rare cancer that occurs in a type of reproductive cancer in women. I guess there may be a male equivalent of a certain type of germ cell tumor in the testes that might produce high levels of HCG. But those are unusual types of cancer, and I don't really think you can apply that test to all and sundry cancers. And the concern I have for a test like this that is so specific. You know, when we do tests, we want them to be both sensitive and specific. A sensitive test picks up things. Okay, great. You pick up things, and you don't want to miss things. But a test that's not specific, that means it's picking up too many things that might not be real. So, for example, they say that mammograms are pretty sensitive for cancer. They may catch 90% of cancers, but they're not specific enough because a lot of what they find, three-quarters of the time, it's a false positive. So that's not a very specific test. It's not, and it engenders unnecessary biopsies. Yeah, and that's a precaution. Sometimes it's useful. And unnecessary apprehension, too. And,
absolutely,
that's not good. So, I would just say, I don't know why you're checking for HCG. That's really, to me, kind of a harebrained way of determining if you're at risk for cancer. And I don't think there's any dietary way to raise or lower your HCG. I wouldn't really worry about it.
Lois, check in with your doctor and have a good discussion with your doctor about your worries about any cancer or anything like that or any risk factors you may have. I think that would be the best way to go.
I believe in, enlightened self-care and self-empowerment. Mm-hmm. But one of the pitfalls of that is that there's so much information out there that people can latch on to information that I think is of dubious quality, and they can develop like cyberchondria. They can think they might have this or that or the other ailment when they're perfectly fine.
Yeah, there is a cyber hypochondria. Wasn't something written in the New England Journal of Medicine?
Yes,
recently about this?
Yeah, there was actually a case study in the New England Journal of Medicine about a woman who, just constantly was on the internet and constantly came up with ideas about this or that or the other malady that she might have. And they tested her thoroughly because they didn't want to ignore her complaints. But when they determined that really nothing was wrong, they referred her to a psychiatrist. And the first behavioral modification that he recommended was she said the psychiatrist said that this woman needed to go on an internet diet. she needed to
an internet free diet.
Right. She needed to withdraw, because she was hooked on the internet. She needed to go through like a withdrawal, and it was very hard for her to do it. She went cold turkey on the internet, and then gradually she was allowed a little bit of time in the internet, but she was asked not to visit sites pertaining to illnesses because it would just engender all kinds of concerns and worries unnecessarily. Look, obviously, we don't want to condone this for our listeners because we're internet-based and we provide, I think, reasonable and unbiased information. Yeah. But then again, there are problems with quality control on the internet. There's no there's
anybody anywhere can create a website and have an agenda that's non-scientific, not true, and deleterious, really.
And alarming,
And everybody's so addicted to their electronic devices. It brings to mind, there's a rest area. It's not even a rest area on the LIE. You've probably seen it, Dr. Hoffman.
Yeah.
Text area.
Right.
I think it's somewhere in the 40s.
Right.
Look at that. It says text area.
Yeah, when I drive to the beach, to my weekend home, it's an hour and a half. I can actually deal with no connectivity for an hour and a half. But I guess some people can't. You know, it's, in fact, it's nice. You know, it's kind of like you tune out. But unfortunately, cars will be, there will be more connectivity in cars. You'll be able to, you know, just text, you know, just, you know, so as not to interfere with driving, you can do it with voice texting. And they're going to have Siri-like devices that are going to take your voice messages and transmit them so that you can, like, jabber all the way to your destination 24/7. That's a little much.
The keyboard will become obsolete.
Yeah.
No more thumb tendonitis.
Right. Oh, well. Okay.
Okay. Our next question comes from Stephanie. I am an avid vitamin herb supplement user, including some of your own formulations. I am 5 weeks pregnant and was wondering if it was safe to continue my regimen as usual. Stephanie, stop.
Yeah.
Go see your obstetrician and check everything with your obstetrician. Obstetrician. So that's the first order of business, really.
I'm all for that. The only problem is I feel that obstetricians sometimes are unduly alarmist about supplements, and they may they may just wave their hands and say, "Oh my goodness, I don't even know what the heck this is. This is much too much. Don't you just take care of this prenatal?" And the prenatals are the prescription prenatals. I think are very weak. And do not have premium ingredients and don't really address some of the real concerns that we have. So, I mean, that being said, I think there are certain things that are pretty innocuous that you wouldn't think could cause a problem, but might cause a problem. One example is EGCG from green tea. You know, EGCG is a wonderful thing for a lot of people to take. It's anti-cancer. But for the same reason that it's anti-cancer, it may be anti-proliferative. Proliferation means, like, you know, multiplication of cells rapidly. Guess what happens during pregnancy? Cells proliferate rapidly, almost in a cancer-like fashion, but in an orderly, programmed way so that the embryo develops into a fetus and into a newborn. And maybe, just maybe, you don't want to take a lot of EGCG. I don't think it's been demonstrated to be big-time harmful. You can drink a couple of cups of green tea while you're pregnant, but maybe not, you know, don't take handfuls of ultra-concentrated EGCG during pregnancy. That's one example. But, you know,
I would be careful with herbs. Certainly,
She
should run that by her doctor or at least an experienced nutritionist.
Yeah, we'd like to do the prenatal counseling because I think we provide a little bit of a, you know, more reasoned approach to that. We don't say drop everything. We say here, this, and this, maybe something you want to steer clear of. But that, and that are helpful things. Let's talk about some of the helpful things that we might, you know, obviously.
The helpful things, besides the a good quality prenatal, we do like additional DHA. For eyes and brain, for brain development.
Right, the omega-3.
The omega-3s, exactly, DHA. We do like phosphatidylcholine as well.
Mm-hmm. For the same reason.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for the same reason. In addition, now, the good quality prenatal, with everything we're learning about the MTHFR allele, it would be good.
Watch your language here. This is a family program.
Yeah, I know.
Can we explain what that is briefly?
The MTHFR, methylene tetrahydrofolate reductase.
Good job.
Did I do it? Oh, my God. Yeah. Oh, what a mouthful.
Wow.
So it's a mutation that's apparently is common in many, many people. These people with this MTHFR mutation don't process folic acid well from a supplement. They will process folate from food, from your dark green leafies and so forth, but the preferred supplement form of folic acid is to get L-methylfolate, or methylated folate is really what we're talking about.
And it may play a role in prevention of birth defects. We know that even good old-fashioned folic acid helps.
Right.
But here's something that somebody explained to me that's really interesting about the causation of autism and developmental abnormalities in babies. What they're saying is that some babies who might have been stillborn because of really severe neurological deficits are kept alive and sustained because we're now using folic acid. Okay, so at least great, fantastic. We're preventing horrible neural tube defects, and the baby is then born. What then happens, however, is that because of these high doses of folic acid, that the baby's receptors for folate are very, very avid. They really require higher doses of folate, not folic acid, to prevent developmental abnormalities from progressing as the baby matures into toddlerhood. And it therefore, the folic acid may be counterproductive. And what is necessary is for the mother to take folate, the methylfolate form of not folic acid, but it's the form of vitamin B4. And then for the baby, if we can identify that the baby is at risk, to get a little bit of that too. Now you can get it from, obviously, from green leafy vegetables. I think that when mom breastfeeds and takes the methylfolate, she will impart some of that methylfolate to the baby. But if the baby is not breastfed, well, then the baby goes cold turkey on a nutrient that it needs very badly. And that may be part of why babies seem to be born normally, and then they cease to progress normally, and they regress. They start to go haywire. But, I mean, just one theory. I mean, it's one among many.
Yeah. Breastfeeding is very important. I remember my first clinical rotation during my dietetic internship was, you know, the promotion of breastfeeding at the hospital where I was training, Jacoby Medical Center. So that was one of the first things that we had to do during the first week. So, very, very important. So, Stephanie, please check in with your doctor.
And one other nutrient that we did not, we gave short shrift to, of course, is vitamin D. And the amount of vitamin D that is in many commercial prenatals is maybe 400 or 800 international units, and that is really not sufficient. It's now recommended that, and I generally test women for vitamin D, but we'll supplement anywhere from 2 to 4,000 or 5,000. Mm-hmm. But it's important to get tested to see what your levels are, because that can really create a big impact for babies, and it will actually reduce their risk for autoimmune diseases and various types of health problems.
Yeah. There was a study, I think it was a Danish study, that showed a reduction in the diagnosis of type 1 diabetes.
Yes.
Juvenile diabetes in children who had ample vitamin D levels, whose mothers during pregnancy had ample vitamin D levels. These were families that were followed for about 17 years.
Yeah.
So it's fascinating, really.
Yeah, so please, if you're even if you're before you're getting pregnant, when you're contemplating pregnancy, both men and women should consult integrative prenatal specialists, and that's one of the subspecialties that we have at the Hoffman Center, and we love working with people who are contemplating pregnancy. And you know, during my tenure at the Hoffman Center, many of our Hoffman Center staffers they started as young gals working for us, and then they got married, and then they had kids, and I have to say that every single one of their kids is a genius. They're all doing amazingly. Their kids are so fantastic, and I want to take some credit for it.
You're the one who recommended the additional fish oil. So.
Fish oil and all the other nutrients that go into that equation. Yeah.
Absolutely. Right.
So anyway, this is a logical point at which we can pause. Let's stipulate this is part one of today's two-part Q&A with Layla. We'll continue with additional questions in part two and give us a little preview of what our listeners can expect in part two.
In part two, Miriam writes, my son has 23 white patches on his back.
Okay, we'll talk about white patches on the back in our part two of today's Q&A with Layla. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.